Let's begin. My name is Chris Tyler. I'm from Seneca College, and we've been working with getting students involved in open source. Quick introduction to the problem. Many people become involved in open source when they're students. However, most of the people that get involved in open source when they're students don't do it as part of an official course. They don't do it as part of their official learning. They do it on their own. You'll recognize at least one, if not two or three of those faces there as examples of students that have done this. But here's the problem. This is a slide from Dirk Riel's presentation. He works for SAP Labs, he's an economist, and this is his graph of the growth of open source. He has several other graphs, they all fit the same curve. It's an exponential curve. So this means that the predominance of open source in our industry is starting to look like pretty much a guaranteed sure thing. It's becoming a dominant model for the production of software. And yet, if we're not training people in operating and developing within that framework, within that model, then basically we have an epic fail of educational institutions. So this is generally a bad thing. Let's take a look at what it means to teach open source, or what some of the problems are in teaching open source. And I think the largest one is that everybody is overwhelmed by the task of teaching this. The students are overwhelmed because they are dealing with, oftentimes they have to deal with code bases that are orders of magnitude, several orders of magnitude, larger than they encounter in their toy projects. Even large projects at a university or a college are thousands of lines, maybe tens of thousands of lines. When you take them into the larger open source projects, they're suddenly faced with millions of lines, in some cases tens of millions of lines of code. They're also walking into a strange culture. And you know what I'm talking about. We're all part of that culture, but it is a strange culture where you're working with people in other time zones, you're working with people of other language groups, working with people that have very different backgrounds and interests and so forth. You have a sort of synthetic culture there. I'll talk about that more in a moment. But I think one of the main things that overwhelm the students is the fact that we're asking them to unlearn and to basically do a 180-degree spin on some of the things that we've already taught them. We've taught them that their work must be original, they must not plagiarize, they should not share results of research that they've done. Submissions must be, you know, entirely unique, that type of thing. And yet, they get involved in open source, the exact opposite is true. We expect them to share everything, to do everything out in the open, to reuse code, and so forth. Faculty and institutions get overwhelmed when they have to teach open source, largely because of the rate of change. If you cannot reuse anything from the previous semester, or very little material from the previous semester, because the open source projects in which you're teaching have switched from CVS to Git, and from MediaWiki to DecuWiki, and they've changed their build infrastructure and so forth, that can become very expensive to stay on top of. We're finding at Seneca, where we've been involved with open source, we're discarding 1/3 to 2/3 of our material each semester. We're amazed at the rate at which it becomes obsolete. For the community, having a bunch of students come into your community all of a sudden can be overwhelming to your developers, where they are already up to their eyeballs in just keeping the project going. Suddenly to have an influx of newbies concentrated in one particular area, and where those newbies' schedule is different than the community schedule, where their semester assignments and so forth don't necessarily match release dates, it can be very hard to absorb those students, especially when there's a good chance that they're going to leave when their course is over. So you have a huge investment, minimal return. That's a significant problem. What we really need to do here is turn a student into a contributor. That's our end goal. If we're going to really prepare somebody to work in open source, we need to take the student, make them a contributor. Let's look at what's involved in doing that in open source. When we look at this phrase, we see two words, and the second word doesn't count, because any sort of software development is going to have source code, right? It's the open part that makes open source unique. So if we look at that, what exactly are we talking about when we say that it's open? What makes that different? How do we have to teach that differently from regular software development, and in fact, software development there being distinct from computer science? I would say that one of the first things is that obviously it's community-based. Open source being community-based means that there's some social issues that come into play. You're doing everything in the open, you're communicating with people, you're working across time zones, across cultural barriers, that type of thing. In that social group, which is self-selected, there's an interesting tension between the need to maintain some sort of coherency so your project goes forward, and yet not be overly strict with the discipline so that you provoke a fork. This leads to a whole bunch of issues that are not present in a traditional small development group. We have synthetic intermediate culture. When I'm working on, let's say, Mozilla development with people in Asia and people in Europe, the culture within that Mozilla group is not that of, it's not my culture. It's not that of a Canadian professor in Toronto. It's not an Asian culture, it's not a European culture, it's something different. It's a synthetic combination of those cultures with its own words, its own terminology, its own practices, and so forth. Another challenge in teaching open source is the code base that we're dealing with. We talked about it being massive, in many cases hundreds of thousands of lines to millions of or maybe even tens of millions of lines of code. That's very different from what the students have encountered, and it's too big to load in their brain. When you're dealing with 15,000 lines of code, you can load that into core, right? And you know where to look for particular things. When you're dealing with, I'm going to use Firefox as an example, using 6 million lines out of the total 10 million line Mozilla code base, there's no way that you're going to be able to load that into your mind and learn that entire code base. So the students need to be comfortable with being productively lost, not knowing everything about the code, and yet still being able to navigate, still being able to work productively and get things done. Code bases in open source projects are often older. Now, old can be 6 months, 18 months, in some cases, a decade or two decades. If you think back, X-Window system, you're probably looking at the oldest code being, about 22 years old. Students are often taught how to deal with development right from the beginning. So you plan things out at the beginning, you build on that plan, you executed it, knowing the end from the start. That's not the case when you're dealing with an established code base. Now, that's a skill that's useful outside of open source as well, but it's not one that's commonly taught. When you're dealing with a code base that is huge and old, you need some tools that the students may not be familiar with. Sure, you know, version control, these kinds of things are things they should have some exposure to, but not version control that is absolutely required or you'll be totally lost. But code searching tools, things like LX, MX, OpenGrok, communication tools, these types of things are needed in an open source environment. They're not needed in others. And here's a phrase that could be used either way. Organic architecture. Most open source projects have sort of grown. The end was not known from the beginning. There's new use cases, there's new interest within the community to take the code in directions that were never originally envisioned. So that means that things have been bolted on, some cases new languages have been bolted on, there's wrappers around things, it's sort of growing through the years. Organic architecture involves, no UML. I put this in for some of the profs at my college who are convinced that students must know how to plan stuff out right from the beginning. Definitely no UML, no clear roadmap from the very start. But some good things. Yes?
Just thought I'd mention that to some of us, UML means user mode Linux.
Unified modeling language, right? Structured development. The organic architecture, though, does bring some things with it. Most open source projects have developed in a way that they are fairly flexible. They're modular because different people are maintaining different parts of the code. And necessarily, the interface between those parts becomes fairly well defined. You've got a fairly clear lines of authority as far as who's module owner and who controls check-in for the different portions and so forth. And oftentimes, we develop extensibility frameworks. So there's plug-in frameworks, all sorts of ways that code can be added to a project in a fairly simple, easy way. So all of those challenges are also strengths. It is a strength, I think, to learn to deal with huge code bases. It's a strength to learn to deal with code that already exists before you were born in some cases. And it's a strength to deal with code that has grown over time and is extensible. So in our Seneca model, this is something that's evolved over the last few years. I'll talk about the history of this a little later. But we typically start with preparing faculty. We found that it's essential to have a faculty member that has one foot in an open source project and the other foot plainly in the academic world. You can picture that if you are trying to teach open source entirely from outside of the community, pushing the students into that community, that's almost guaranteed to fail. Likewise, if you're inside that community but you don't have any understanding of the academic requirements and the interface to the other courses and so forth, that's also setting you up for failure. So we've become convinced that we need a faculty member who is firmly planted in both worlds. Secondly, we need to select a community, and not all communities are suitable for teaching within. A colleague of mine, David Humphrey, pointed this out when he said, can you imagine taking a whole class of students into wget? It just wouldn't work. You can't take a large group of students into a very small project. You need a project which is large enough, which has sufficient scope, that students can get involved in different areas of that project, in some little corner areas, in build systems, in testing, and so forth, so that they don't overwhelm that project. You can spread them out. Next, you need some potential projects. These cannot come from students. When a student selects a potential project within an open source community, they'll usually pick something the community doesn't care about. If you want to get traction, we've found that it's essential that those projects come from the community. The kinds of things that developers would do if they had more cycles, the kinds of things that the community's had on their wish list for quite a long time and just nobody's taken it up. So we'll approach an open source community and we'll say, what are some of these things? What are things you'd like to see done, but you just have not been able to do? And typically, we try and arrange a list that's maybe 3 or 4 times longer than we're going to need. So that when the students come to select a project, they can select something according to their passions. And yet, it's still something which is of interest to that community. And then finally, there's obviously some infrastructure preparation. We found it best to teach within an open source community's own infrastructure. So, not setting up some little sandbox somewhere where there's a fake Bookzilla and there's a fake CBS and so on that's only open to the class. By far, it makes much more sense to teach within the community's infrastructure using their Bookzilla, their mailing lists, and so forth. However, there are a few places where it makes sense to set up some separate infrastructure. A couple of those. One, it makes sense to have a wiki that is specific to the courses that you're teaching. That way, course-specific material can be placed on that wiki and kept separate from the community's material. However, it's a good idea to use the same type of wiki software that that community uses. If they're using MediaWiki, definitely use MediaWiki. It'll be less confusing for your students, but more importantly, members from the community will feel comfortable coming over and making corrections in your learning materials or adding material to that. Likewise, in terms of infrastructure, we found it useful to set up a separate channel for students on the same IRC project that the community is using. So for example, when we're teaching in Mozilla, we use irc.mozilla.org. We have a Seneca channel on there. That's a bit of a sheltered place because there are regular flame wars, of course, in developer channels. That's not a good thing for students to encounter right off the bat. Maybe as an observer, but certainly we need a place where they can get comfortable with some of those tools. So our Seneca channel on irc.mozilla.org has been running for probably 3 years. There's maybe 24 developers that are in there all the time. So it's because it's on the same servers, it's easy for the devs to pop over and to visit.
Just a quick question. What kind of students or level of students are you talking about? Are you talking undergraduate, graduate, PhD students? Just your experience seems to cater towards undergraduate.
We are using aiming these courses at senior undergraduate students.
Okay.
So they would be students that are typically in their last year of undergraduate studies.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk more about where we're taking this
in
a moment. There's some new directions that we want to go. Mm-hmm. Okay, so with infrastructure, a couple of things on the side of a wiki using the same software as the community, an IRC channel using the same servers as the community. These things have been helpful. Actually teaching the courses, we typically start by teaching communication. There's usually a short introduction to open source, so we talk about Cathedral and Bazaar, that type of thing. But right off the bat, we get the students involved in communicating. So that means that probably on the first day, we're going to require them to set up a blog. We're going to require them to have that blog feed into a Planet aggregating the posts of all of the students in that course. We're also going to require them to get onto IRC and to join the mailing list of the particular community in which we're teaching. Next step up is usually project selection. And the reason that we teach this after communication is that the students are encouraged to go to the people who originally suggested the projects and get more details. Now, we're not asking the people who originally proposed those projects to stay with the students throughout the duration of the project, but simply to give them some pointers right at the beginning to say, this is what I meant. These are the kinds of things that need to be done for this particular project. Question back here.
You said you get them communicating first. My experience with a lot of new grads is that email means running Internet Outlook, and that means they have no tools to actually cope with actually subscribing to any mailing list with any volume. So I'm wondering if you teach that part.
That's certainly something that they encounter. We've warned them about it, but oftentimes we let them experience it as maybe the fastest way of teaching them. But some of the open source work that we've done has been cross-platform. So sometimes students have been on a Windows platform and so forth. Other work has been specific to Linux. But yes, we have had to give them some instruction on, brace yourself for the level of mail that you're going to get. Particularly once they start shadowing people on Bugzilla. And that's just an avalanche that most of them have never seen or even imagined before.
Why not just teach students how to use the filter capabilities in Outlook or to use the Gmail gateway so that the messages appear as news groups on the mailing list?
Certainly those are approaches. Setting up a separate Bugmail account is something a lot of people do. And yes, there's several approaches that can be used there.
Well, it's as simple as the fact that Outlook puts everything in a proportional font, which makes quoting and following replies complete garbage. So they can't even read it if they use Outlook. Whether they filter it or not, if you used Outlook, the student actually can't follow the thread of the conversation, right? You've never used it and seen non-technical or semi-technical people try to do this. You're like, why are you doing this? Click, 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 click. Can you read it now? Oh, well, now all of the last 6 years of my life makes sense now.
Right? Certainly, those are some of the skills that the students need to pick up. So as we have the students head into project selection, usually, even around the second week, we have them talk to the people in the community who had proposed the projects originally. So they're getting clarification, they're starting to zero in, and out of the list, remember I said the list was 3 or 4 times the size of what we're going to eventually need, we have the students focus in on an area of passion. That's the open source way. You get involved where there's an itch or there's a passion, and we want the students to do the same thing within these open source projects. Again, that's one of the reasons for choosing the larger open source projects. There's lots of scope for different people with different passions. Next thing up is usually teaching build. Most open source projects have their own way of doing build, and it ranges from a little bizarre, like the Mozilla build system, to extreme, like OpenOffice. that's been a nightmare for even some of our faculty to get up to speed on building OpenOffice across all of the platforms. Once we are there, we start getting to tools and methodologies. And here's where we find an advantage to keeping all of the students within one large open source project, as opposed to being involved in a number of smaller, different open source projects. We can teach the methodologies within that one large project, at the same time those students are involved in different areas. So for example, again using Mozilla, we can teach a cohesive course about Mozilla, even though we've got a couple of people that are working on BuildBot, some people that are working on JavaScript performance testing, you know, and very different aspects of that particular project. We found it essential to have the students meet the community, and by meet, I mean not only online, I mean face-to-face. There's just something special and important about actually meeting some of the top devs in the community in person. So the projects that we get involved with, we ask them to work with us to bring in a couple of their top devs throughout the semester. We videotape those and make those available back out to the community, so it's our way of sharing that back to the community. And that has a fantastic impact, has a lot of value, certainly for the students, but I think also for the community, also for the developers that are involved there. Question here.
Are you guys CS department only? I'm a silicon vendor, and so we're always looking for people to help write device drivers, things like that, but it's more of an embedded world. It's kind of crosses that line between EE or CE, CS, can be CS. So, but it sounds like yours are pretty, very, very software off the hardware.
We do some embedded work, and we have a electronics design program, and we have some things going on between us and them as well.
Toaster.
In terms of releases, we expect the students in their first open source semester to do three releases. And we say that those are a 0.1, a 0.2, and a 0.3 release. The 0.3 release, the concept there is that it's not a final, fully polished project, and yet you know that a lot of the software that you use daily is actually 0.3 release, and it's been 0.3 release for a long, long time. So we expect the software to be in a usable state, but maybe not fully polished by the end of that first course. We offer a continuation course, or we have been offering a continuation course where students take that 0.3 release up to a 1.0 fully polished release. The students do the releases in an open source sort of way. They make them available somewhere, and they blog about it. And that ends up on their plan. That is actually how they submit the coursework in the open source courses. All of that, their course submissions are done by blogging, and we pick that up on the planet, and that's their submission. And then finally, we expect cross-contribution. So we expect the students to contribute to other students' projects or to other open source projects, either within the community or within related communities. So there's a significant portion of the mark that it is for that. We want to develop a sense of not just single focusedness on a particular project, but a sense that they're participating in a larger community. We also expect students to make it easy for other people to contribute. So we say, you know, if you hate documenting, make it easy for somebody else to document. You know, blog that you need some documentation done, or you need some test cases written, or you need the stuff tried out on hardware that you don't own, and make it easy for other people to participate there. And we have both community members and other students jump in and work on each other's projects. A little bit about our experience. We've been working with open source on a user level for more than a decade and a half. So we've been teaching the use of Linux, the use of Apache, the use of all sorts of open source packages for many, many years. We started to get deeper into that about around 2001. And that's when we switched all of our labs over to a dual boot or tri-boot configuration. We started teaching the use of GCC and the GNU toolchain from the first day that students came into the software development program. And we've encouraged them to install alternate operating systems, open source operating systems. We have an install fest each semester, and we've really encouraged that for quite a while. But the big change came about 3 years ago when we switched from being teaching students to be users of open source to being contributors within the open source community. And this began with the Mozilla project. So my colleague David Humphrey was doing a research project with some touch-based input devices with a local company. They needed some software that they could configure for a touch-based interface, got in touch with Mozilla, and at first it was, you know, is there something we can do here? Maybe you can be doing some funded research with us. And Mozilla said, no, this is great, we'll come, our devs will work with you and we'll get this stuff going. And that collaboration was so successful and so strong that we decided to take that into our courses. And that was really the turning point for what we've been doing. So it's been about 3 years that we've been working with Mozilla on a fairly deep level. David Humphrey has been leading that. I've been working with him over the past year and a half, 2 years. We are expanding that into some other open source communities, which we'll talk about in a moment. In terms of failures, I'll talk about failures before I talk about successes. There are some students who are just not really open source people. And our biggest failure there is students that do not work with the community, students who try to go it on their own. And actually we found working with very large open source projects to be beneficial here because the larger the project, the less likely it is that the student will be able to do something on their own. It almost forces them to interact with the community and communicate with other developers in order to get useful stuff done. Most of our failures have taken the form of fizzles rather than spectacular flameouts. But we've had a number of students that have just not gotten into the collaboration, the community aspect of open source. But in terms of successes, we've had, I would say, far more successes than failures. And I'll highlight just a couple of those. One is APNG, Animated PNG Graphics Format. Andrew Smith, a student of ours, took this on, and actually originally as a Google Summer of Code project, to implement an animated extension to the PNG graphics format. Now there is MNG, which is a graphics animated format supported by the PNG working group, but the MNG spec is large and difficult to implement. In fact, I'm not even sure if there are very many complete implementations of MNG out there. Mozilla project at one point had an MNG project underway. They eventually sort of shelved it because it just didn't seem to be going anywhere. But they needed a lightweight graphics format. As you know right now, a lot of animated cursors are PNGs that are overly wide, and we just sort of jump between different sections of that single image. It would make a lot more sense to have an image format that had timing information and disposal information and so forth embedded in it, and yet had the benefits of PNG, 24-bit, full alpha channel, and so forth. Andrew implemented this in a fork of libpng, then successfully merged that into Firefox. This was a very interesting project from a political point of view, because a lot of discussion was provoked with the PNG working group. Ultimately, they rejected the APNG format. So, it's working, Mozilla likes it. After Mozilla picked it up, Opera picked it up, there's word that Microsoft is going to pick it up and use it in IE, and yet, officially, it got rejected as a standard. So that was a very good and very difficult learning experience for this particular student. So that shipped with Firefox 3, just a short while ago. Another Mozilla project, a student of mine, Fima Kaczynski, implemented code to watch and monitor plugins. As you know, when Firefox slows to a crawl or becomes unresponsive, a fair bit of the time that's actually due to a plugin. In most cases, a proprietary plugin. I won't mention the company that their initials are Adobe. So a lot of time the Firefox program is getting blamed for things which are actually D2 plugin. So one of our students was interested in, and the community was also interested in, some code that would monitor plugins, give some feedback on when they'd gone astray. We had an interesting challenge with that, in that the deeper we got into it, the more challenging it looked, to the point where eventually we got in touch with some of their developers, Rock in Australia and some others. And they eventually said, you know, what you're trying to do, although it'd be really cool, we don't think it's possible. We don't think you can do that. But the student persisted and was able to implement Plugin Launcher as a two-part solution. So there's some hooks, some monitoring hooks that have been added to Firefox. In order to get those accepted, he had to do performance testing to prove that he wasn't slowing down the browser and jump through a number of hoops. But that was accepted, and that's in Firefox 3. Along with the part that's in the core Firefox, there's an extension that monitors and displays to user information about plugin load, does that as a sort of dynamic bar graph. But there are other extensions as well. There's ones that do logging for developers to do analysis of plugins and that type of thing. The plugin code was so rusty and abandoned, as far as we can tell, nobody had touched it for at least 6 years. It was just off in a corner, and it worked, so nobody touched it. So that was, again, another interesting experience for that particular student. But not all of the students' work has ended up in shipping projects. Some of it has been infrastructure related. So for a long time, the Mozilla project had wanted to move from Tinderbox to BuildBot for their build systems. One of our students was able to do that. Their build team was too busy to actually do this thing that they had on the wish list for quite some time. One of our students took that on, figured out what it would take to convert them over to BuildBot, and made it happen. And he's now working for Mozilla Corporation, and he's their chief BuildBot guy. They still use an aspect of Tinderbox for the display, but BuildBot is running behind the scenes. Question there?
So for something like that, how do you mark that if you're, as a course?
Well, some of these projects definitely are hard to mark. What about a test? You know, test cases where somebody's come up with a large set of test cases. Infrastructure types of things. Sometimes even a documentation project. We had a couple of students that went through and documented a large undocumented API. So these are not sort of traditional development projects, and yet we've worked through how to mark those. And it's largely a matter of, it's partly based on the community's acceptance of what they've done, but also the completion of the objectives. Has the student successfully done what they had set out to do? A couple others. DiskCC did not work on Win32 until a couple of our students took that on 2 years ago. And now DiskCC works with Sidewind on Win32. And I think there's a MSIS set of patches that are in the works as well. Also, translation tools. One group of students thought it would be useful to have some tools that would let you take a localization and apply some rules to that to produce another similar but slightly different localization. Here's an example. English US and English Canadian are not very different. There are a few words that are spelled differently. There are a couple of URLs that are different. And yet, to maintain separately English US and English Canada, and whenever you make a change in one that you remember to go and make the change to the other and so forth, is a chore. So they've developed a set of tools that take a set of rules that say, these are the rules for converting English US and English Canadian. And then the active development takes place only on the English US branch, and then these tools automatically do the few spelling corrections, URL updates, and so forth that are necessary for the English CA branch. You see that in a number of language groups, you've got sort of national localizations of a particular language.
It's brilliant. Does it work with any good text-based stuff as well?
Unfortunately, this is very specific to Mozilla, in part because they use a really unique way of doing their localizations. So unfortunately, it is very specific to the Mozilla stuff. Stuff that we've learned. Definitely, we've learned that open source is not for everyone. However, even for students that don't take actively to open source, we found that there has been a value in exposing it to them. We've had students that have gone through this course, or the set of courses, and come back a couple years later and said, look, I'm in a totally proprietary company, but I just found a place where open source would be perfect, or we want to get involved in open source in this particular aspect. And if they hadn't had this exposure, then they wouldn't have those opportunities. We've learned a number of things about quite a bit about the appetite that communities and companies have for people that know open source. Basically, the students that have taken these courses are disappearing straight into industry right after they graduate. We're trying to avoid the situation where they disappear into industry before they graduate, but that's a bit of a problem that we've been having, and it's a good problem to have. Next. We are doing some new things. We are taking this methodology and applying it in some new projects. I'm going to be working with the Fedora project. I've been working with the Fedora project in different ways for quite a while, but I'm going to be taking some students into the Fedora project using these methodologies in the fall. This is a bit of a departure because Fedora isn't, to a large extent, Fedora is not a development project. It's, as a distribution, a meta project, where packaging, integration, testing, these are the main activities of that project. So this is going to be a bit of a departure for us. Our school actually runs two halves to the house. We have a development half, and we have another half that's focused on administration, testing, these types of things. So I'm going to be teaching open source methodologies in the other half of the house. The other thing is that this is, for the first time, in answer to question earlier, this is going to be to graduate students. This is a graduate certificate for people who have a degree, diploma, and probably work experience in the industry. So these are people returning. This is a one-year program, and it's quite intensive. The other thing is that we're going to be doing open source projects across six courses out of the 10 that are in that program, rather than across a single course with an optional continuation course. So this will allow us to have projects that have much greater scope than we've had with the Mozilla project. We're also doing exactly the same type of thing that we've done with Mozilla, software development and so forth, within the OpenOffice project. And there are two, three, four, the number keeps going up, other projects that want to do this type of work with us as well. So we're planning on scaling up appropriately. We don't want to scale up too fast. Our biggest challenge in scaling up has not been really with finding the students. The challenge has been in finding the faculty, where we need a faculty member to be deeply into a particular open source community before we want to teach in that community. We're having to get faculty members up to speed in some of these communities that they may not necessarily have been involved with previously. Finally, I wanted to leave you with a few things that communities can do to make it easier for students to get involved. In fact, any new contributor to get involved. One of the first things I'd say is make it easy to do your build. So, if you can package up the tools necessary to do your build and make it easy for somebody to get up to speed on that, that has tremendous value. Some projects have done that. We see that within Mozilla, where the tools that you need to build on the Windows platform have been packaged up. We see that to some extent with OpenOffice, where they've got the GoOO stuff. But it's still harder than it should be in a lot of open source projects. So if you want new people to get involved, make it easy to get started by making your build environment easy to establish. recommend a start page. The information, if you imagine the curve that a student or any new contributor must go through to get involved in your community, as an experienced member of that community, you're probably way up here on the curve. But that little first very, very steep part of the curve is the part that we see over and over and over again as we bring students repeatedly into this community. The people who have been in the community for a while, you can go and you can look at your start pages, you can look at your entry pages for people coming into your community, but you're going to look at it through the eyes of an experienced person. If somehow you can shed that and you can look at those pages, you'll in many cases find a bunch of sort of up-to-date information linked to other pages that have very similar but not quite the same information on them, with different parts of the page being obsolete, and you've got sort of this link farm of old information on how to get started with the project. It's very, very common. We're encountering this over and over and over again. It's worthwhile tasking some people with maintaining that start page and keeping it up to the minute as your practices evolve.
That sounds like a great thing to give one of your students as part of your course. Because it's one of the areas where the open source projects are traditionally the most lazy and unforthcoming about. So
there is a problem with that, though. You have to learn it before you can document it. Yeah.
Well, they are learning it over the years, so at the end of the year, they...
Absolutely. An interesting anecdote with that, once we taught Mozilla, after the first year, the first couple of times through the Mozilla course, we found that students, when they were Googling for information on how to get started, were usually ending up back at our wiki. So we've taken, as much as we can, we've taken those resources, and as you say, when a person's starting, they're not in a position to write that stuff. But once that's been refined, we've had a few iterations through, then we're taking those resources and we're moving those back into the communities with you. That seems to be an important thing.
So that's actually some of the best people to do it, is because they're targeting people who are coming from the exact point that they're at the beginning of the course.
Exactly.
And if you're going to test with somebody, you got to test with somebody who's starting and says,
yes,
this is confusing.
Yes. So the next iteration of the course is a good place to do that.
And it probably helps to have at least one project out there that's really well documented, a really great example of how it should be done. They point the other ones at and say, well, this is what we should be doing.
Do you have an example of a really good one?
Not yet. we're looking, but and hopefully as we feed back into these communities. Actually, one other thing that's been really interesting for us is because we've seen that start of that curve across a couple of different projects, and as we head into other projects and we start to see it in other projects as well, we're starting to see where one community has done something really well and the other community's totally not got that down pat. Where we're finding that we may be able to become a clearinghouse of best practices just because we see that startup ramp several times over. I'm going to recommend that communities create some sheltered places. And by sheltered places, I mean places where new contributors can come and not be exposed to the full flaming blast furnace of the developers channel on IRC. So maybe that means that there's a list to introduce yourself, or there's a procedure for introducing yourself to the project. Maybe that means that there's a newbie developer channel. You may need some places where people can come, they can dip their toe in, and start to get up to speed before they get involved with people who've been there forever and are likely to pounce on you with a question that's maybe obvious to an experienced developer. Further on, if you are getting involved, if your community is getting involved with students, a couple of recommendations. Let the community know, not just one corner of the community, the whole community should know that there are some students that are going to be getting involved. The community should feel free to meet the students. So that can be done in several ways. The devs can come in and guest lecture. The devs can pop into the students' IRC channel. There's a number of ways in which the community can meet the students. But that has a lot of value. Getting the students at your conferences, at your development conferences, has enormous value. But whether that means taking your conference to a city near where some students are studying your stuff, or whether that means subsidizing their travel, or putting it in a less expensive city rather than a more expensive city, there's all sorts of ways to encourage students to participate in those events. Contribute materials. You know your project best. You are the best people to contribute learning materials, teaching materials into those projects. So that can be as simple as checking out the course wikis and fixing problems, or adding resources, or adding some links there. It can be very low overhead. You can just mail off your favorite dozen links for your particular project to the prof. Blog about them. There's all sorts of ways that materials can be contributed. And then finally, and I think this is most important, treat students as new contributors. Don't treat them differently, but of course make your projects welcoming to new contributors of all types, whether those be students or other types of participants. I'll post up, I haven't posted it up yet, this morning was a little nuts, but I'll post up some links to some Seneca resources on my blog a little bit later today. Questions? Yes?
Have you had any interest in similar courses or wanting to know successes from other institutions?
Yes. We have, on a weekly basis, several discussions with other institutions. A couple of things we found. There is a lot of interest in teaching open source because that's where industry is going. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, open source software development is a very practical, hands-on topic to teach. And we're finding that schools that are very much math-based CS schools are finding that this material is not a really good fit for them. So in some cases, those schools, they're keen to do open source, but they just can't find a spot to plug it into the curriculum.
Why is that?
Just the orientation. It's pragmatic, practical stuff versus theoretical. Mm-hmm. So we were set up to do some stuff with some schools in Japan, and that fell through just because it couldn't find a place to plug it in. Same with some schools in France, although that was somewhat successful there. If you're involved with an educational institution and you're interested in this kind of stuff, there's a list. It's presently hosted at Red Hat, but that may be a temporary thing. It's the OSIE list, Open Source in Education. And a number of schools are involved with that. So we've got ourselves, Carnegie Mellon, a whole bunch of schools, largely in the States, but we're starting to get some from around the world that are involved in that list. Traffic has been really low so far, but partly that's we started it just before the summer. Hopefully there will be good traffic there. Yes, one question.
Coming at it from another angle, I've been trying on and off for many years to get a master's degree so that I can teach at the college level. I teach part-time at community college. I can't go full-time without a master's degree. And going from open source development to trying to get a master's of education from Ivory Tower Academia, I want to kill most of my professors to defend students from them. Is there anything that can help there? I've had professors who are literally teaching out of a textbook a technique developed in 1970 that totally does not apply, but is the standard technique they teach.
I have to half apologize and half point the finger at the educational system for doing that. We are seeing the same thing. We have students, we have a bachelor's in software development, not computer studies or computer science, but bachelor's software development. And those students should be able to get into a CS master's program. And yet, all of them from our first cohort were denied that, just because there's this gulf between CS and software development. And there is no easy solution to that problem, but it is a very frustrating problem.
I got approved. I took courses, and I could prove that what they were teaching fell into the already know it, could have learned it if I cared, or this stopped being relevant 8 years ago and you haven't figured it out yet.
Yes. There's a real disconnect there between what's being taught in some contexts and what's going on.
And part of it is that Seneca is much more community, trying to get people jobs and not way up the ivory tower.
Right. We have, for the Americans in the audience, we don't map into any level in the American system, really. We are somewhere between a community college and a university. We have 2 and 3 year diplomas. We have 4 year degrees. We have some graduate certificates. But a very pragmatic orientation, which lends itself well to open source.
MIT had open courseware stuff. Have you guys looked at doing something similar with the share, sort of the course material will open up so that it evolves?
We teach open source in open source ways. So that means that all of our material is entirely out in the open. Even student submissions, as I said, are done on a blog, which is aggregated through a Planet. Of course, materials are all on a wiki, and that's all out there. But by the same, I should say, in the same breath, many, many people have approached us saying, can we reuse your curriculum? And we've found that it's not the curriculum that's important. The important thing in teaching these students is being a link, not mentoring them in a traditional sense, but being a link to link those students with resources that are inside the community. So even though all of our material is available, I think the what's really necessary is to find people to be those matchup people. So when an open source project is trying to bring people in outside of a course context, I think those are the type of people. You almost need a new position, not a mentor. You need people in the community that are willing to do that kind of match up work to bring people past that startup curve.
So I have a question regarding, you're very hands-on programmer focused, right? But
yes.
Open source methodologies matter a whole lot. For example, I'm currently doing a part-time master's degree, and what they're teaching in project management in particular is very interesting with regard to the rather iterative models. Also, I'm happy that the professors actually are open to learning about that. But, you know, are you doing any sort of research or sponsorship, for example, into analyzing how to interact with the communities, you know, beyond just simply coding, if you know what I'm saying? In the more like soft skills as associated with software development. You're like focused on programming, but open source has relevance to businesses who are involved with communities as well.
Yes, and their scope of some projects exceeds software development, so we can do some projects with that.
Okay.
Well, our time is up. One thing I want to just mention as I step aside, we are having there's a free software and open source symposium that we have in October each year. If you're interested in open source and education, that might be a worthwhile thing to check out. And again, I'll put some links at the address that I had posted on the screen a minute ago. Thank you.